This week saw the passing, the death of a person who has had a huge positive impact on many, many people. If you've been paying attention to local news at all, you probably know that a well-known Manitoba musician named Vince Fontaine died this past Tuesday. And I'm not mentioning that just to kind of regurgitate the news, but because there are a couple of deep links between that event and the grief of the loss and the community of the table. And the most significant, the closest of those links, as those of you that check in with Facebook might know, is that Amy is Vince Fontaine's niece. Vince's Uncle Vince to Amy. My own connection with Vince goes back a ways as well, so I have a collection of unique memories from the occasions when I got to work with him and the band Eagle and Hawk in particular. I never worked with him in Indian City, but with him and Eagle and Hawk as a photographer. I did some album photography for them way back when, and also had some encounters with Vince as a kind of an adjacent support to some of the musical ventures that he was a part of. So some personal interactions. And Vince was, among other things, someone that in my experience, championed others. I watched Vince many times pushing younger artists and activists to the front and supporting them and amplifying their voices. He was, as all of the sort of online observations about his life have mentioned, pretty much a member of the Saguin First Nation. And in my life, Vince was one of the early voices that helped me make some progress on the often painfully slow journey, for me at least, of moving from, you know, Indigenous people are a group I know next to nothing about other than stereotypes, the vast majority of them negative. From moving from that to, I am grateful for the friends in my life, some of whom are Indigenous. Vince was very kind to me along that path, and I'm forever grateful for his kindness. And although, of course, his passing and its tragic sense of being deeply untimely is something to mourn, his legacy, even from my limited, very limited personal perspective, never mind this huge impact beyond that, his legacy is something to celebrate. And if you're interested in being a part of that in an embodied way, there's an event in celebration of his life at the Odina Circle at the Forks starting at 1 o'clock today. And I'm not exactly sure what the details of that all are. They're available online in lots of places. As Vince and lots of others continue to remind us, we are all of us parties to Treaty 1 in this part of the world, and here in, as Vince was fond of saying, here in the center of Turtle Island. And reconciling the wrongs perpetrated before, under, and subsequent to that treaty and its relatives, the other treaties across this continent, that's still unfinished business. And it's business in which we all have a stake. So my invitation to us this morning as we get underway is that if you choose to participate in this part of our gathering today, I want to invite you to breathe on behalf of those feeling the loss of Vince most acutely today. I want to invite you to breathe in their sadness. That might sound like a strange idea, I'm not sure, but it's an invitation nevertheless, to breathe in their sadness and just hold it for a moment. You know, we say things like, you're in my thoughts and you're in my prayers and you're on my heart, and we mean them. You know, they're not untrue. They can sound like tropes, but they can come from a place of real authenticity and truth for us. This is an embodied way to enact that. So breathe in their sadness and just hold it in you for a few moments. If you're counting in the mindfulness practice that we sometimes use, perhaps hold them inside of you as you cradle your breath for however long you do that. And then when you breathe out thankfulness for the legacy that Vince leaves for so many people. All right, let's do four rounds of that together this morning, and so we can kind of be in a shared space, and then we'll go on with our exploration. All right. If you're able, somewhere where you can sit comfortably, feet flat on the floor, your hands at rest, so you can breathe deeply. Here we go. Thank you. Peace, everybody. And in particular, peace to those for whom today is a day in which your grief and your mourning may be more acute and present and public. I said last week that I wanted to spend a few talky bits exploring some ideas we touched on a while ago, and central to those ideas and where I'm going to spend most of the talky bit today is the importance of something that I'm just going to call personification. And the short version of that idea is that when we care about something or we want to care about something, our brains are wired to personify that thing, to give it human characteristics. That's not really a big surprise if you think about the way we tend to value things in the world. As most of you know, we have a little dog in our house named Mika. You may have heard her during our breathing together. She doesn't care what we're doing in here. I grew up with dogs. I grew up with big, messy outdoor dogs that pretty much ran semi-wild in the wide northern outdoors around our rural home in northern Saskatchewan where I was growing up. Crean didn't grow up around that version of pets. And in our family, Crean's and mine, we've never had house pets until we got Mika. And Mika joined us shortly after Corrine's mom died. There was a how do you even describe what that season feels like? There was an achy hole in our lives. There was a sense that something living and breathing and warm and interactive needed to come and be in that aching space. And that something was a little ball of fluff that could pretty much fit in my hands when we brought her home. We were, no surprise, for those of you that know Crean and I expect, we were determined to have a well-mannered, well-trained house pet. And in our minds, we thought that meant, among other things, you know, a dog that slept in a kennel at night. And we were, to our credit, I would say, we were sticking to our guns on that one, despite loud complaints from Mika about it. But then events took an unexpected turn. Because it wasn't that long after we got Mika that we had a house fire that was significant enough that we had to move out of our home for a few months. And some of you have heard this part of the story before. I use it as a reference point for a lot of different things. But we had very kind next door neighbors that spent winter somewhere warmer, and this was in the winter. And so at their kind invitation, we moved into their house. Mika and her kennel went into their basement at night. The idea being that it was a little easier to stick with our guns if we couldn't hear her. But there was a problem with this arrangement, which was that there was some kind of a duct in their house that went right from the basement, pretty much, it seemed like, into our bedroom. And we could hear every, you know, heart-rending nuance of her lonely nighttime crying from the dark of the basement. I won't try to imitate it, but when she cries to this day, it is an incredibly plaintive noise. Well, some of you know how this story goes. Not only did she migrate from the basement to the main floor, but from a distant room on the main floor to our room, and then from our room to our bed, which is now her bed that we are also allowed to sleep in. And so, you know, if you visited our home, you might also know that she has her own chair in the main room. And may mercy be granted to any naive visitor who doesn't know the deal and thinks they can just plunk themselves down there without the puppy's permission. Basically, Mika's like one of the kids. She calls us mom and dad because, of course, she can talk. And we make sure that we give her love and affirmation as well as food and water, you know. Oh, my word. Anyway, think what you will. That's a longish story, but it's a very personal illustration that I live with every day of what I'm basically talking about when I talk about personification. I love that little dog, and my heart will ache when we lose her. it aches a bit even considering that kind of a loss. Now, this next bit might seem a bit out of proportion for a few moments, but stay with me. My mom, as many of you know, has recently been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. We're all dying, of course. I remember reading a poem to that effect when I was in, I would say, how old was I? I was probably just before junior high that I studied this poem, and I remember thinking that the poet had a uniquely bleak view of the human experience. I feel differently about that now. We are all dying from the moment we enter the world, but it's different when everyone in the room knows it, and there are suggested time frames, and there are details around it. That's an ache as well, of course. And it's both a completely different ache than the one that I've been talking about with Mika, and also quite a related one. One very important difference is that I don't have to personify my mom, because my mom is already a person. Personifying her, speaking about her, thinking about her, using language in my interactions with her that is personal, personified, that's not something that I consider or I reflect on or I regard as optional or feel, as I do about Mika perhaps, that I need to explain to others and maybe even feel a little bit, you know, abashed about. I don't have to wonder if my love for my mom is out of whack with her role in my life. She's my mom. And that pretty much covers it. Now, one similarity between those two, and this is a powerful one, is that I wouldn't even consider telling these two stories as though they had anything in common if I didn't personify Mika. Talking about her and even in many ways thinking about her in personified terms, by which I mean as someone, not just something. Now, significantly, this is just as powerful in reverse. I gestured toward this in what I said at the beginning about Vince Fontaine and my ways of thinking about people that are ethnically, that identify as indigenous, to say of any people group they are, is at best to tread dangerously close to depersonalizing. I'm in the middle of reading a book called 21 Things You May Not Know About the Indian Act, about Canada's so-called Indian Act. And although group language kind of makes sense in the context of trying to write about larger collectives, I find myself just flinching from the phrase "the Indian" in so many of those government documents, as I think I should. Now, this might sound like an extreme example, but this is how we train soldiers. This is how we help ordinary people become more able to kill other ordinary people. We train our soldiers, and this is not just true about one country. This is fairly universally true about training young soldiers. You are being trained to kill the enemy, not, you know, Bill or Mary or Steve. This past week, I read a short story based in the time of World War I with its trench warfare and its hand-to-hand combat, in which the wounded protagonist does a fair bit of speculating about how these same young men that he was directed to kill may well have been his friends under other circumstances, that they were like him. And the only way that he could do what he was being commanded to do was by using slang names for the people group that the people that he was commanded to kill came from in terms of nationality or ethnicity. If we can depersonalize, we can ignore, neglect, consume, abuse, destroy with relatively less emotional engagement. This is why I cringe at a phrase like, I might get mail about this one, like the wife. I know that there are all sorts of other reasons an appellation like that, you know, might be problematic. I also know that in some contexts it may well be considered by the speaker as an expression of affection. But in the context of this discussion, it can serve as an example of depersonalization, of shifting our thinking about an individual from personal to categorical, from a relationship of I, thou, to I, it. Our brains inherently relate, and they relate by giving human characteristics to what is other than human, including, we might well remember, what is more than human, what is, as we talked about recently, transcendent or beyond. If we don't do that, if we don't personify, or if we back away from it in the way that I was talking about with a phrase like the wife, we don't have a healthy relationship. We don't have an I-thou relationship with what we are so closely linked to, what we might even depend upon for life itself. You might remember that the last time we talked about these ideas, I quoted a thinker named James Hillman. I think that that quote bears repeating. Hillman says, love is a way of knowing. And for love to know, this is the crux of this, for love to know, it must personify. Personifying is thus the heart's mode, or we could say the self's mode, of knowing. It's not a lesser, primitive way of apprehending, but a finer one. To enter myth, we must personify. To personify carries us into myth. I know I'm a bit of a sound loop on this, but myth, as I'm using it here, means guiding story or story that puts us in accord with the nature of reality. Lots of us grew up, swimming in the idea that the stories of the religion we were in were literal records of physical events, what we might tend to use a word like history for. Myth, in that frame of belief, was bad. On a good day, it was equal to fairy tales. On a bad day, it was evil. And on every day, it was the enemy of truth, truth being what was presented as what was literal. And defending that frame sometimes required ideological contortions of circus sideshow proportions, as well as requiring a version of faith that often also equaled checking your brain at the door, not thinking too much about what you were doing, or treating information that was contrary to the stories as suspect despite mountains of evidence to the contrary. It required, in many instances, living with beliefs or in ways that could not be reconciled to reality, that could not put us in accord with reality. I would say that it's no wonder so many people want nothing to do with that collection of stories, or with people who find them believable, or even interesting. If you learn about something in black and white terms, and you find that it doesn't stand up to more substantial scrutiny, it's hard not to react to that discovery in black and white ways, because we were trained that this was a black and white reality. Take it or leave it can easily turn into leave it. By which I mean leave it in its entirety as a lump, like we would treat anything else that we depersonalized so we could treat it like a lump. That is so different. I'm not saying this should suddenly work for everyone or something like that. I hope this is clear in our setting, that these are catalytic ideas. They'll resonate with some and not with others. But that take it or leave it, that black and white way of thinking about those previous experiences and stories, that's so different from, instead of take it or leave it, try take it as a catalyst for imagining your own way forward, or take it as a jumping off point for imagining a better world, or take it as the gateway to seeking a guiding story that lets you sleep at night. I keep thinking about that Over the Rhine tune that we did at Christmas, where toward the end, the songwriter references the teachings of Jesus and kind of sums them up in four simple lines in the song, one line of which is, put up your swords forever. Well, stop being violent. Put up your swords forever. Stop thinking and acting as though conflict and violence can actually resolve things. That's an idea that can guide us into deep accordance with the reality that we can observe over and over again, that violence does not, in fact, resolve things. but exacerbates them. We don't have to believe any particular thing about Jesus, for example, as a spiritual teacher who said, put up your swords forever. We don't have to believe any particular thing about Jesus to recognize that as an idea that grounds a very significant reality. So that's an example of what I'm talking about here. Or how about this? We could take the mythology we know, whatever that might be, as we considered last week when we, you know, plugged Amos into the axial period, we could take the mythology that we're familiar with as the contextual wrestling with reality that us humans have always done, that is one of our most important human endeavors, and that you and I do every day. We don't always do it consciously, but we're always doing this. We're always measuring these kinds of things. We could take those mythologies as stories, as guiding stories, passed along to us from ancient thinkers, from people that were exploring what they believed and coming to conclusions that they found believable, using the understandings they had of the world around them to the best of their abilities to guide them into ways of living that they experienced as being in accord with reality. We could take those kinds of stories as people personifying reality as they encountered it, providing them with a way to relate to it, to care about it, to take it seriously, to know it, as Hillman suggests, with their hearts, which is to say, to learn to love it. It's an interesting exercise, at least to me, to revisit ancient mythologies with this knowledge about how our brains work in view. Do you ever wonder why the storytellers in the Genesis poetry bother taking up space talking about how an essential human task is naming things? Naming things? Just set aside entirely, if you can, the image of a pair of naked white people. I mean, like, you're going to now try to set this aside. A pair of naked white people wandering around a garden with no weeds, pointing to an animal with a super long neck and super long legs and saying, giraffe, you know. The point of the story is not that this is how the animals we know got their names. The point of the story is personification. What we personify, we learn to love, to know with our hearts. And what we know with our hearts, we care about. We take care of, we care for, because we can love that. Our brain allows us to love that. It's intriguing to me that in those stories, for example, which are one way to think about personification, that act of personification of the world that surrounds the humans in it presents that act as synchronous with a world in which the humans and their surroundings were in right relationship with one another. The humans were living in a way that was in accord with reality in those stories. And so the mythological picture of how beautiful that synchronicity is where we get our ideas of paradise, right? Now, with that in mind, what are some of the realities that we're surrounded by these days that we might need to personify so we can learn to love them with our hearts and not just understand them with our minds? Places where we need to move from an I-it relationship with something to an I-thou relationship with something. Now, there might be quite a list that could follow a question like that. But what I want to do today is leave us with one example, just to stir our own imaginations. There is an organization called Conservation International that seems to have a pretty good grasp of this principle of personification that I've been talking about. And they've released a series of short videos under the banner Nature is Speaking. And what they've chosen to do, and have the resources and connections to do apparently, is to have a bunch of Hollywood A-listers provide the voices for what we could call the main characters of the world that we think of and experience as our home. And so they've produced personifications of water, of the redwood, of the coral reef, of the soil, and so on. As I said, I think there's about 10 of them. And the one that I want to leave us with today is the one for Mother Nature, in which Julia Roberts speaks not for Mother Nature, which is, you know, just those degrees removed from personifications we've been talking about it, but as Mother Nature. So the way the thing is shot and voiced, it is a personification of Mother Nature. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave it there for now in terms of the talky bit, and I'm going to share the video with you. If you're listening to this on the podcast version and you want to check out the video, because that doesn't translate very well to a podcast, a quick Google search for Nature is Speaking or Conservation International will lead you to this series of videos, and to this one in particular should do the trick. And then next week, so this is a catalyst again, this is just to get our imaginations thinking about that question, what are some of the realities we're surrounded with these days that we might need to personify so we can learn to love them with our hearts and not just understand them or approach them with our minds. And then we'll pick it up somewhere around there when we get together next week. Peace, everybody. Bye for now.